Hi, this is Tess Vigeland, and you're listening to the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of August 20th, 2010. The jobs picture in this country just doesn't get any better. And for those dealing with long-term unemployment, it feels like a dust bowl of opportunity.
The drought continues. The best bright spot that we've had recently is I've been targeting a lot of companies that have September 1 fiscals.
We'll have an update on two families we met earlier this summer. Plus, we take a trip down to New Orleans. 5 years after Katrina, the workforce is new and different.
When I was evacuated and watching the devastation on TV, I remember turning to my husband and saying, it's our kids' generation that's going to have to rebuild the city.
But first, Fannie and Freddie. A couple of good names for a favorite aunt and uncle, yeah? Well, suffice it to say, they are far from favored in Washington these days. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were on the hot seat this week, figuratively speaking, of course. The home mortgage giants currently in U.S. government receivership are facing all kinds of questions about their future role in the housing market. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has been following the story. And Mitchell, you know, we keep hearing how important these guys are, guy and gal, actually. Remind us what they do.
Fannie and Freddie are these government-chartered and, of course, now government-owned mortgage institutions. Basically, they do two things. First of all, they set underwriting standards, pretty tight ones right now, and that guarantees home loans. Then they buy them up and repackage them as mortgage securities. Now, that is key because without that, banks can't move mortgages off their books and then lend again to the next home buyer who comes in the door.
All right. So what happened this week on the Fannie and Freddie front?
Well, it was a one-day talk fest, more or less, on what to do with these two giant government lending institutions. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner sort of set the tone.
It is not tenable to leave in place the system we have today. We will not support returning Fannie and Freddie to the role they played before conservatorship, where they fought to take market share from private competitors while enjoying the privilege of government support.
And so now we'll see the debate play out. The administration will have its reform plan ready in January. Congress is going to start work. Republicans already have position papers for what they want.
All right. Well, let's go through what they do want. A lot of different folks wanting a lot of different things.
Right. And, you know, it kind of breaks down to Democrats and populists on the one hand. They want some continued government role, although definitely a smaller role, to support home lending. And Republicans and fiscal conservatives say basically it's time to cut the government lifeline, let the housing sector rely on private investors and financial markets alone. But, you know, as you heard from Geithner, it's not like anyone really wants to leave the situation as is. Everyone says they want the private sector to start investing again and take on some risk. But here's the irony. Most economists agree that it is unbelievably dangerous to try to dismantle these government lending institutions.
Why is that? Why is the economy so vulnerable if that happens?
Well, because right now, Fannie and Freddie guarantee most of the new home loans being made in this country. Private investment all but vanished after the financial crisis. And these are more or less the secondary mortgage market right now. That is what is freeing up banks to lend. Withdraw the huge government prop for housing now, interest rates would probably spike, mortgages would be harder to get, you'd probably see layoffs in the housing sector. It's not pretty looking.
And yet, it does seem like everybody does agree that Fannie and Freddie at least have to shrink, if not shut down. So what? Are they waiting for the housing market and the economy to make a miraculous recovery?
Conservatives aren't. They want to wind down the government lenders more or less ASAP. But that raises a big question, whether private investors, absent the government stamp of approval on the mortgages, will step in. After all, banks are still shaky. So what if they just don't show up to the party that the Republicans want to throw?
Mm-hmm.
Or what if they do show up, but they demand huge down payments, let's say 30% down on a normal mortgage, or they charge much higher interest rates? And as I said, progressives still want some government entity to stick around and back up mortgages so that middle-class families can afford to become homeowners. The danger here is you leave a big chunk of the U.S. economy dependent on these quasi-government mortgage companies. They've got bad debts on their books, and they've got a guarantee from taxpayers to cover all of their losses indefinitely. I mean, that is a place no one, conservative or liberal, wants to go. But they don't want to kill the U.S. housing market on the way to getting to a better place either.
All right. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman joining us. Thanks so much for your help.
You're welcome.
So we've all heard about the theft protection features on credit cards. Consumers can expect alerts from issuers if, say, they live in California and a charge comes from a mini mart in Texas. But soon there will be a new service to guard against another culprit. You. It's coming to you courtesy of the parental units we call MasterCard. Ron Lieber wrote about the program recently in the New York Times. Ron, welcome back to the show.
Always good to be here.
Tell us a little bit about how this program works. This is the credit card is your best friend?
Ha! Well, that's probably what the card company would have you believe. Look, there's something in it for them, too. But the basic idea here is called In Control. MasterCard is offering it, and banks that issue MasterCard debit cards or credit cards can offer this. And it can do a couple of things. Basically, the big idea is that you can set controls on your spending so that charges that you don't want to make, whether they're happening in countries where you don't approve, where you feel like fraud might be taking place, or if you've gone past, say, a certain limit that you've set for yourself each month, say, no more than $200 in iTunes charges or spending on gasoline or dining. Once you pass those levels, you can actually tell the card to shut you off, to cut down your charges and deny them altogether at the point of sale if you want to.
So the evil credit card is now the angel on your shoulder?
Well, that's what they would have you believe. Look, they lose billions of dollars in fraud each year. And so if they can get consumers to help them, avoid fraudulent charges, then, it helps the banks and it helps MasterCard. You know, the other, sort of truly cynical approach to this, and I'm not sure if I would go this far, but other people have suggested it to me, is that, they're trying to use this as a sort of a public relations ploy to say, look, we're helping people control their spending when they know good and well that not that many people will ultimately sign up for this. Huh. But I'm not so sure about that. I think it's possible that, this could be the holy grail of budgeting for some people who simply can't control their spending behavior, but really, truly, actually want to.
Well, I have to tell you that when I first read your piece in the Times, my first thought was, why can't we just control our own spending? Do we really need a credit card to do this for us, or at least to program a credit card to do it for us? Doesn't that get us off the hook for planning and budgeting and keeping track of our own money?
Well, it's interesting that you use the phrase, off the hook. I think any tool that can help you achieve a goal is a worthwhile tool, as long as you're not breaking laws, right? I mean, look, we have the same willpower issue with dieting, with exercising regularly. And, for those of us who don't get as much exercise as we would like to, if there was some way to force ourselves to do it that actually worked, we'd probably try it.
Do you think that it could serve to do the opposite of what I criticized it for, which is to actually help change behavior? Maybe the MasterCard works as kind of training wheels for you?
I think that's possible. There may be a whole group of people who simply don't want to put themselves in a situation where their card stops working,
right,
whether it was for, a circumstance, where they set the limit or whether the card company cuts them off because they've gone too far over whatever their credit limit is on their credit card. Some people just won't want to deal with that inconvenience or the potential embarrassment. But I think there are plenty of people who would really like to go cold turkey who will find clever ways to make use of this.
This is a fairly novel idea, I think. What else would you like to see the credit card companies doing to perhaps help customers manage their money better, if that's their role?
One of the things that the credit card companies and the banks that issue debit cards could do better is just make their statements more useful. I think it's telling that a company, a site like Mint.com, has been able to sort of, disintermediate the banks from their customers. Mint takes all of your charges on whatever debit and credit cards you use, and it sort of puts them all in one place, and it categorizes them, and it helps you make a budget. The fact that it took some third-party company to think of that and make it work as well as it has is sort of an embarrassment to the banks and the credit card companies, and it's sort of high time that they do that for customers on their own without needing some other site to do it for them.
Ron Lieber writes the Your Money column for the New York Times. Good friend of the show. Thanks so much for your time today.
Always fun to be here.
We were just talking about ways to keep yourself from going bananas with your credit card, cut yourself off from all those consumer choices. Well, another way to do that is by moving to China. A lot of what the world consumes is made there, but that doesn't mean it's actually for sale there. Marketplace's Scott Tong just returned stateside after 3.5 years in our China bureau, and he wonders if consumers here have too many choices.
My first trip back to the grocery store in suburban Virginia began promising enough. My wife Kathy and I ditched the kids with the relatives. We located the milk, the spaghetti sauce, the blueberries. A sprightly clerk even asked if we found everything okay. And then on the way to the checkout, Kathy goes, "Grab some ranch dressing, quick." That is when I encountered the 36, as in ranch dressing choices. You know, that block-long wall of options, the national brands, the store brand, the small, medium, and super-sized bottles, and, of course, low-fat versions of all of them. The choice can be paralyzing. In our time overseas, I somehow forgot about all the availability here, compared to China, which has 1 billion people and no ranch dressing. When we lived there, we'd fly back to the States every summer and stock up on salad dressing powder, and then sneak it into China for special occasions. Now, just before moving back to the States, my advice-giving friends warned it would be an adjustment. Yes, I'd prepared for reverse culture shock, and now it's upon me. Shock upon re-entering the atmosphere of so much of everything. Paint colors, cell phone plans, paper towels, ranch dressing. It's a screaming reminder of the truism that our economy is still powered by us. We have endless choices and credit cards to swipe and not even have to sign anymore. Now, don't get me wrong. Chinese consumers are well on their way. Every day in Shanghai, another phone hits the market, or car, or junk food chain. But for every middle-class person developing our habits, there's at least one Chinese saver who consumes zero. Like our nanny back in Shanghai, she would reuse every Ziploc bag, rinse it out, hang it on the faucet to dry. And you know what? The other day I caught myself reusing this itty-bitty square of tin foil, even though Virginia reports no apparent shortage of tin foil. And so I've changed a little bit. I don't consume as much, I hope. I don't throw out as much. And my shopping efficiency has definitely declined. That day I found myself in the ranch dressing forest. I was so slow picking one out, my wife had to pull out of the checkout line and wait for me. So much for grabbing something quickly.
Our former China correspondent Scott Tong, now back in our D.C. bureau, pondering his choices. Time now for your questions on all things money-related. And with me to take your calls this week is our own economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Tess.
Now, I understand that you have a big weekend coming up next weekend.
Oh, I do. Taking my son, my youngest son, out for his freshman year of college.
Oh, my goodness. Emptying the nest, so to speak.
Tess, it is possible to hold two contradictory emotions at the same time. Because on the one hand, I am so happy that he is starting the next stage of life.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, I'm going to miss him horribly.
Oh, so part of you is going, woohoo, and the other part is going, crying.
Exactly. But it's going to be a wonderful moment, and that'll be it.
Now, are you then dealing, I assume, with the hefty bills that go along with this?
So the first semester's all taken care of.
Yeah.
And then gone through the health insurance plan, which, by the way, is extremely important because typically you have a choice to go into a health insurance plan that's offered by the university or the college, or if your employer offers a plan, you know, stay on the employer's plan. So, you know, look at the two plans, which one you come out ahead. By the way, for most people who have an employer-sponsored plan, they're going to come out ahead with the employer-sponsored plan, but you got to look at that.
Really? Better than what schools generally offer?
That's right.
Now, how are you dealing with the question that we actually get quite a lot here on the show of how do you deal with money issues for a kid that's going off to college, you know, setting up bank accounts, some sort of allowance? What are you doing?
So the bank account has been set up, and he has his debit card, and he has his checking account, and we have access to what he's doing, and not because we're really interested in what he's spending the money on, but just, you know, to see what is going on in terms of the budgeting, and there's a certain amount of money, and then we'll monitor it, and I expect that he's going to make mistakes. It's the only way that you learn, right?
Right.
The advantage is it will be, by definition, a limited money mistake. We'll stay with the budget, and we'll see how it goes.
All right. So, shall we get to the business of the day?
Okay. Absolutely. Little finances.
Yeah, enough about us, right? All right, Gene is on the line, and he's with us from Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi, Gene.
Hello.
How are you doing today?
I'm fine. Thank you very much.
Yeah, so Chris is sending his final child off to college. Have you sent some kids off yet?
Yeah, I've had two kids who have been there and done that.
Been there, done that. All right. So tell us a little bit about yourself. Again, enough about us. What do you do there in Charlotte?
Well, I am the principal clarinetist with the Charlotte Symphony.
Wow. How long have you been playing?
With the symphony, I started playing with the symphony in 1975.
Did you start playing the clarinet as a kid?
Yeah. Started when I was in grade school.
You know, we've talked to you before, haven't we?
Yes. We spoke several years ago, and I guess this is kind of a follow-up call.
Remind us what you called us about before.
I called about helping my son, who lives in L.A., with his mortgage payments. I remember very well what the advice was, and unfortunately, I did not follow your advice.
Oh, well, I believe we have a clip of that advice here, so let's listen to that real quick.
I actually think there's a lot of consequences to this decision in terms of your financial intertwining with your son. This isn't going to be a great investment for you, but as a parent, I can't tell you not to do it.
All right, so Gene, you promptly ignored that advice?
I did.
Okay, and tell us what happened.
Originally, my son got in over his head with a subprime mortgage loan.
Okay.
He had an 80-20 deal. He had a condominium. It's a three-bedroom condominium. He was going to rent two rooms and use that income to make his mortgage payments.
Okay, and just for the audience, what an 80-20 is essentially you take out a first mortgage for 80% of the purchase price, and then you have a second mortgage on top of that. Some people call that a piggyback loan.
Right. So he was very enthusiastic about this idea, but he needed help, and I agreed to pay off the 20% part of the loan.
Okay. How much money are we talking about for the second loan?
$70,000.
And how did you pay for that?
I took out a second mortgage on my home.
Oh, boy.
My home was paid off. And the plan was that in 2012, he would sell the condominium and repay that loan to me.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I didn't anticipate was that he would not be a good landlord. So he had roommates who did not pay the rent. And he was too nice of a guy to kick them out, and eventually they foreclosed on him. And by losing the property, he lost his ability to repay me.
He's still employed? Your son is still employed?
He does not have very much of an income, but he is employed.
So what are you thinking you might be able to do here? You're not going to send this into collections on your son, right?
No. I've accepted the situation. I am making payments on this loan. And my question boils down to whether or not I should accelerate my payments. I have a 30-year fixed interest rate loan. That's 4.875%. I'm 65 years old. I can handle the monthly payments very easily.
Okay.
By adding $200 to that monthly payment, I could pay it off in 15 years. And I'm wondering, at my age, if I should consider paying it off in 15 years versus 30 years.
How about having your son pay that extra $200
yeah,
for you?
Yeah, that would be my reaction.
Well, that would be nice, but here again, I doubt that he could afford it. He's barely getting by.
But what if, say, he did $50 a month? I think that still would be a good thing. It would help accelerate the mortgage payments. He'd still be helping you out.
Yeah.
You know, maybe in a year or two, he might be able to boost it up to $200.
But then in the meantime, should Gene go ahead and start doing that just to get this mortgage done with in half the time?
Yeah. I mean, I have sort of mixed feelings. And, you know, normally people shouldn't have a mortgage when they're retirement. You know, so that would lean toward let's accelerate it, let's get rid of it. But I think Tess really does raise an important point about having your son help you do that so it's less money coming out of your pocket because you've helped him out. But I think it would be good for him to, you know, also help you that you're not carrying any debt as you get older.
Uh-huh.
Gene, have you talked to your son about this?
Well, only to the extent that he's unable to repay me as we had planned.
Right.
I haven't asked him about helping make a certain portion of those monthly payments.
I think it's really a conversation with your son. I think that's the bottom line. And I think you've actually thought it through You know, it sounds to me this has not caused a strain between you and your son.
No, not at all.
And I think this, I mean, frankly, I think it'd make him feel better if he can help pay down this debt. It's going to help both of you.
Yeah.
All right, Gene. Hope that helps you out.
I thank you for that input. This time I'm going to listen.
Very good. All right, Gene, good luck, and thanks so much for the call.
Thank you so much.
All right, and finally we have Emily calling from, oh my goodness, Amsterdam. Emily.
Hello.
You're calling from the Netherlands?
That's true.
Well, then I'm guessing that you listen to the show on the podcast.
Yes, I do.
Chris, I know you're a world traveler. Ever been to the Netherlands?
I've been in the Netherlands. The first time I was in the Netherlands, I was 9 years old because we moved to Germany for 3 years and we took a freighter. And where we were dropped off was Rotterdam. And then when I was a merchant seaman, one of my ports of call was Rotterdam. So I've actually been to Rotterdam a fair amount.
So what brought you there, Emily?
Work. I moved here 3 years ago. I work for Greenpeace on their climate and energy campaign.
Is there a big expat community there?
There is. There's a large expat community in the Netherlands and in Amsterdam specifically. So it's nice. So you always feel like you're in a party.
Well, I think that's not the only reason you feel like it's always a party in Amsterdam.
Yeah, well, there are other things, of course, as well. But some of us have jobs, so we don't necessarily indulge in those sorts of activities.
Well, Tess, you know, it's really fascinating because the Netherlands, you know, it's a shipping hub, global hub.
Pot hub.
Well, okay, now we're talking about different kind. We're talking about legal commerce or different kind of commerce, you know. But it's made it very attractive for skilled workers to come from around the world and work there. And the way the whole Dutch tax system is run is to encourage skilled foreigners to come and work there. They really want to be an international hub.
Oh, that's exactly how it is with Greenpeace. Their international headquarters is in Amsterdam, and I have a knowledge migrant visa, which gives me a lower tax rate than normal people.
You know, I lived abroad for a time about 10 years ago, also in Europe. But frankly, I thought that the tax situation was very, very difficult to figure out. So can I make an educated guess that this is about taxes?
Yes, it is very much about taxes.
All right. So is this confusing for you, figuring out who to pay what?
Well, I didn't even know until about 2 weeks ago that all this time I should have been filing with Uncle Sam, and I found
out.
Yeah, and I found out because I was actually thumbing through my passport, and at the last page of the passport there is this little note saying, hey, American citizens, don't forget while you live abroad to pay your taxes in the U.S., and I was like, what?
Yep. Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Okay, so how long have you been there?
3 years.
All right. Have you talked to anyone from the IRS?
No, I haven't. I haven't called them yet. I actually called you guys first.
Okay.
To just kind of have a game plan first before I jump into this, basically.
Right. Okay. Well, Chris, I'm sure that Emily's mind has gone automatically to worst case scenario that the IRS is going to hit her over the head and say, give us the money.
No. I think this is not the situation to panic over or get upset. I think it's actually pretty straightforward how to deal with it.
Right.
But I would not contact the IRS. But what I would do is work with CPAs, American CPAs in Amsterdam. And there's actually a fair number of them. As you said, Emily, it's a very large expat community there. And so I did an email correspondence with Tom Collard. He's a CPA based in Amsterdam, about your situation without identifying your name or anything like that. And what is clear to me is, one, taxes are really complicated. Tess, nothing has changed.
No.
That said, it's pretty straightforward how to straighten out your situation. But the fact, if you go to a professional, they're going to be your advocate. And my guess is, in the end, you're fine.
Okay, that sounds good.
So, Emily, you're going to take care of this, and then are you planning to stay there for a while?
I'm definitely going to take care of it, and I'm actually moving back to the U.S. quite shortly. To go to law school. So I need to have my affairs in order as soon as possible.
Well, glad that we're going to get you back here in the U.S., but boy, what a wonderful experience.
Yeah, it's been a tremendous amount of fun, and I'm very grateful for the opportunity, but also happy to be coming home.
Well, safe travels, and thanks so much for the call.
Thank you for your help. I really appreciate it.
Well, if you've got a money question, obviously, even if you are abroad, internationally based, we will do our best to answer it. Do give us a call. The number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, or send us an email through the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. Chris, it's been awfully fun. And boy, enjoy your time next weekend taking your kid off to college.
Thanks a lot. And you know what? I intend to.
And remember to always check with your own financial professional before you make any big money decisions. Teaching your kids the value of a dollar can be daunting, especially when summer jobs are hard to come by. But Mike Lane of Wofford Heights, California, came up with an innovative way to teach his daughters valuable lessons in finance while making a few bucks on the side. Our technical director, Josh Rogerson, left the control booth to take a ride to the Sequoia National Forest, where he met up with two tween entrepreneurs.
Is there anybody under 95 pounds? Nice one. I can tell who's going to be the troublemakers on this trip.
Every summer, Abby Longero heads up to California's Kern River Valley to work as a river guide. She's done this since 2001 and never worried much about money. But she turned 27 this year, and she started to pay a bit more attention to her spending.
So I probably have about $4,500 in credit card debt, and at the end of the summer, I can probably put around $2,500 to $3,000 down on my credit card.
Sticking to a tight budget isn't easy when the going rate for a place to stay in the valley is about $300 a month. But Abby shopped around until she found a place for just $100 with an unusual landlord, or landladies.
My name is Megan Lane, and I am 10 years old.
Hi, my name is Emma Lane. I am 12 years old, and I'm going into the 7th grade.
Renting a place from a pair of preteens may sound odd, but it gets odder still. Megan and Emma Lane's house is located in their backyard, 10 feet off the ground, in a tree.
This is Emma. There are 3 oak trees growing through our treehouse. Oh, 4 oak trees.
This is Megan. There's a sliding glass door and a veranda with a railing.
The treehouse is 106 square feet. With a bed and a desk. There's electricity, but no running water. Abby uses the bathroom and shower in the Lane household, a few steps away. The girls didn't come up with the idea to rent the treehouse themselves. Their father, Mike Lane, is a middle school teacher, and he knows firsthand that educating students about money is not a priority in most American classrooms.
Certainly up to the middle school, there is very little done to teach kids the value of money and how to spend it.
Mike thought renting out the treehouse could provide lessons in personal finance to his daughters. Lesson number 1, find the right tenant, someone you can get along with and who you can trust.
We probably pretty much have to know them to even think about letting them stay in the treehouse, because some people say that they're one way and they're really not. And we want somebody who's friendly.
And person that pays the rent on time.
Lesson number 2, get the place ready to rent.
Before she came, we swept it all up.
I mostly did the carrying down, and she did more of the cleaning.
Lesson number 3, how to manage the money you make. The Lane girls split the $100 a month they charge for rent and are surprising their dad with their fiscal discipline.
They will spend about 20% and then save 80% of it, which is probably more than I would have done. So, Emma, last month you received $50 for rent, and then you had $10 to spend. What did you spend that money on?
I spent it on a little pouch for my friend.
This is Megan. I bought a thing that does your toothpaste that you just lift off the hand and toothpaste sparks out for my friend Taylor.
But don't let all that generosity fool you. The $40 they each put in savings are for big-ticket items for themselves. Emma's already reached her next savings goal.
So what are you saving for right now? What's your big thing you're saving for?
An iPod Touch.
But Dad has some ground rules she must follow before she can start to spend.
If I have the exact amount of money, they want me to have $50 or $100 more so I don't just drain my bank account.
So you don't have any credit cards?
No.
Mike admits to having a somewhat casual relationship with money, and he doesn't want his daughters growing up the same way.
I've always enjoyed money, but I personally have not really been tied to money. I wanted them to respect money a little bit more and understand that it just doesn't grow on trees. You work hard for your money, you get money, and then there's certain benefits that come from that.
What kind of does grow on trees in this case?
Yeah, right. In this case, it does. It's in the trees.
Abby's tenancy means the Lane girls can learn some valuable lessons about money while enjoying their treehouse all year round. It's a bit too hot for them in the summer, but for Abby, it's perfect.
I think the best thing about the treehouse is, like, when I say I live in a treehouse, people look at me like I'm kind of nuts. But then I tell them that I have 3 skylights and a balcony and Wi-Fi and electricity. Pretty bomber.
From the inside of Megan and Emma's treehouse in Kern County, California, I'm Josh Rogerson for Marketplace Money.
We've got Josh's photos of cute kids and trees at marketplace.org. Months ago, in a broadcast from Chicago, we profiled 2 families dealing with long-term job loss. We said at the time that we would check back in with them. Steve Ostrowski is 38, married, lives near the city's Magnificent Mile, and he's been looking for work for more than a year. I asked him this week what, if anything, had changed since our visit in June.
Much of the same. I guess I'd be classified as one of the 99 weekers.
Really?
Yeah, a person that's been looking for a job for more than 99 weeks. And the drought continues. The best bright spot that we've had recently is I've been targeting a lot of companies that have September 1 fiscals.
Hmm.
And the good news is I'm getting some good responses from these companies because they are starting to hire in line with their fiscal year. I've actually been getting a lot of good leads. I've been invited in for some interviews coming up in the next few weeks, which I haven't even had an interview for the last 6 months. So,
wow.
Encouraging signs ahead.
Oh, that's fantastic. What are they saying when they get back to you? And, you know, how do you define good news?
Good news is any news.
Hmm.
Really. Anytime I get a response back, it's good news because I'd say 95% of the time I receive absolutely no feedback from applications. And I think that's probably true for most people that are going through this process, is it's just you call or email or fax, whatever it may be, into a black hole. And when you get any type of response, it's a reason for celebration.
Well, let me ask you then about your state of mind as you prepare for those interviews. It's been a long time since you did any. And you know, we do hear a lot about how chronic unemployment can really affect a person's state of mind and their ability to get back into the swing of things. Any apprehension as you get ready to go into these interviews that you may be a little rusty?
Maybe a little rusty, yeah, but really excited. I haven't bought into the thought of diminishing skills.
Mm-hmm.
I'm even more energized and excited and ready to work because I've been away from it.
Anything different in your day-to-day life now than when we talked to you back in June?
No, we've been really lean. We have a really lean household as it is. We don't have any lavish expenses. You know, we don't have a cable bill. We don't have a car, an auto bill. So there hasn't been any additional cutbacks. We just continue to lead a very lean lifestyle.
You still making dinner for your wife?
Yes, sure am. Pretty much 5 days a week.
Chicago resident Steve Ostrowski. We also met Miles and Iris Bess, 38 and 39. They live on the city's south side with their 2 young boys. Miles has been looking for 3 months now after his second job loss in as many years. Iris has cobbled together some work as a beautician, but it is not enough. When we met, they were packing up to leave their home and become renters. Iris said this week that things are not getting any better.
To be honest, really slow. We're still just pounding the pavement as hard as we can to make sure, you know, we get the house sold. It's in the process. So I'm still in the job hunt right now, preparing the kids to get ready for school. And that's always exciting. I don't know how much of a chore that'll be. You know, sometimes kids want to go back, sometimes they don't, but mine seem to be excited.
Good. Are you renting now?
Well, we're not out of the house yet, but we have a buyer. So haven't found a place to go just yet. The biggest challenge is, you know, they want to do credit check. And just because of the state that we're in as to why we have to sell our home, the credit isn't where they would expect it to be. So we just continue to look different areas and things like that, being in an area that would be affordable but is safe for our children.
Well, how's the job hunt going for Miles?
He's actually looked at some other opportunities to be able to get some continuing education, to get into fields that are more lucrative right now, such as emergency medical technician and some teaching and consulting.
Now, I know when our producer called you up to see if we could do an update on you, that Miles didn't really want to talk to us about this. Has it become even more difficult for him?
I would think so. He's just really focused right now on what he needs to do to make sure that we're okay. And I admire him for that. He definitely makes sure that the kids are good, you know, that we are not at a point where they're not hungry, they're not, you know, missing any activities. We try to keep them busy, but it's, you know, still a challenge.
And are you still working as an instructor at the beauty college?
Yes, I am, but I was informed that that too is short-lived because actual program that I signed up for with Put Illinois to Work, the funds are due to expire at the end of September. They haven't definitely said whether there would be an extension or not, so we're just kind of waiting to hear.
Right.
I've already taken the initiative to do other things.
Iris, when we spoke with you back in June, Miles indicated that within a couple of months, you know, he was worried that it would be as bad as you potentially living out of your car. But it sounds like you have not gotten to that point yet, and you're doing all right?
It's not to that point. I just can't conceive that at all. For one, we do have family that would at least step in and say, hey, you know what, let's help you along the way. But, hey, if not a two-bedroom, if it's a studio, I mean, you know, we just have to do what we need to do until things turn around.
Iris Best speaking with us from Chicago. We'll check back in with both of them in another couple of months. Meanwhile, you can hear our original stories at marketplace.org. There are things that most people would never, ever do, no matter how much money someone was offering. At least we'd like to think so. But sometimes money changes everything. That is also the name of a series we've been running in partnership with CBC Radio in Canada. Today, reporter Sean Cole has the story of a man who crossed a very bright moral line to make a buck.
The guy's name is Noel Biederman, and you might have heard of him. He's the president of a Toronto company called Avid Life Media, which runs a bunch of niche dating sites. There's CougarLife.com for older women and younger men, HotOrNot.com aimed at 20-somethings, but there's one site in particular for which Noel has gotten a lot of attention.
Joining me now is Noel Biederman.
Noel Biederman.
Noel Biederman.
He's the CEO
and spokesperson for AshleyMadison.com.
AshleyMadison.com, a dating site for married people who want to cheat on their spouses.
You know where I'm coming from. I don't know how you live with yourself.
What made you so angry that you started this website?
No, it wasn't about that.
I feel like coming right up there and knocking you out, bud. That's my emotion that are running.
People are always bringing Noel on TV so they can yell at him, but nobody ever really sits down to talk with him. So this past spring, I spent a few days at the Ashley Madison offices.
Hello, sir. How are
you?
Very good to meet you, too.
Because the more I learned about Noel, the more I wanted to talk with him about one thing in particular. His marketing strategy. See, Noel buys traditional ads where he can, but of course a lot of big media companies won't take ads from Ashley Madison. His response? Fine.
I can do whatever I need to do then to make sure that my investment returns, because I'm not doing anything illegal.
So what he does is offer organizations a ton of cash to promote Ashley Madison in outlandish, elaborate ways. Against all reason, he really hopes they'll say yes. And when they say no, he goes to plan B, decrying them in the press for being unreasonable. Last year, for example, the Toronto Transit Commission announced it was doubling subway fares. So Noel offered to subsidize everyone's train rides if the TTC plastered 10 streetcars with the Ashley Madison slogan, "Life is short, have an affair."
At the last minute, though, those wise city councilors who have the veto power vetoed the whole deal. And everyone in Toronto wanted to jump into that debate.
conservative groups are relieved, saying marriage has taken enough of a beating.
The idea that we would
website publicized. Again, Noel really wanted to wrap those streetcars with his ads. And love him or hate him, or really hate him, his reasoning makes sense. News coverage of his failures is one thing. It's fleeting. But if he ever succeeded, the public outcry, and Ashley Madison's name, would be heard around the world. For now, though, he mostly has to bank on failure. Here's another example.
Noel wanted to find one city that had serious budget issues and offer them money to rename something in their city.
So he told this publicist,
Caitlin Coverley,
to email the city of Phoenix, Arizona, and offer them $10 million to change the name of their airport from Sky Harbor International to Ashley Madison International for a period of 5 years.
And within 24 hours, my proposal was rejected. And then the media picked up on it after that.
And was it surprising to you that they rejected the proposal?
Absolutely not. But at the same time, I did enough research to know that there was a slight chance because, let's face it, a lot of U.S. cities are dealing with serious budget cuts right now, and maybe $10 million would be enough.
There's a price for everything, you think?
I think so.
And you could say the very anecdote Caitlin just told disproves her belief, or you could go one further and say that even the specter of money changes everything. After all, every time the media covers one of these failures, or brings Noel on TV to yell at him again, or, yes, interviews him for a public radio personal finance show, more people hear about Ashley Madison and more people sign up. Speaking of which, Ashley Madison has 6 million members. Avid Life pulled down $30 million in revenue last year. So even though its most effective publicity, all the press coverage, is free, it does have a little money to throw at even odder stunts, like this one.
And now, the host of the Tiger Woods Mistress Beauty Pageant.
That's right.
Howard Stern.
Thank you.
Ashley Madison put up $100,000 this year so that Howard and friends could rate the bikini-clad mistresses of Tiger Woods. The winner took home three-quarters of the money. Let's skip to the end.
You are. Here comes Noel Biederman with a check for $75,000. What do you want to say, Noel, from Ashley Madison?
How ironic that Ashley Madison can bring some comfort to a mistress left in the dust, but, you know, I'm happy to do it.
That, to me, seems really gross.
Why is it gross?
Well, because it just seems to be making light out of something that caused pain. It's buffoonish.
How is it more crass than his press conference where he thanked Accenture? That was the most transparent apology in the history of mankind.
Sure, but so, it wasn't a bunch of women shaking their asses. Like, that's
different. I think that's more honest. You know, now they got a chance to saddle up to some money. I think it's as honest as you get. It's called commerce.
There's your flowers, by the way, and there's also golf clubs on the flowers.
Can I ask how much you make?
I don't even know, to be honest.
Really?
Yeah.
That sounds like a lot.
I do really well.
Well enough that his wife doesn't have to work. Yes, he's married, with two kids. Introducing cheaters to each other online has afforded them a pretty comfortable life. And while I haven't mentioned this until now, Noel does tend to defend his business with various theories and arguments about the future of matrimony and where we're headed as a society. But in the end, he says, it really is all about the money. There's no way he'd be doing this otherwise. In Toronto, I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace Money.
Next weekend marks the five-year anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. Residents along the Gulf Coast are still rebuilding their communities. The key is that they came back at all, after so many said they wouldn't. The population of New Orleans has grown faster than anybody expected. It's about 80% of what it was pre-storm. But some current residents were not there when the storm hit. They showed up to help bring the city back. And then they stayed. They've even got a nickname, Yerps. Young Urban Rebuilding Professionals. Marketplace's Eve Tro has our story.
In 2005, Brian Bordanek came to New Orleans from the University of Georgia for a fraternity party. He saw the devastation from Hurricane Katrina. He had a long talk with a cop who was working security at the event. Then he went home and signed up for 2 years with Teach for America in New Orleans. Now,
this will be my fourth year. Can you see? I have, like, the gray hairs to show.
And how old are you?
I'm 24, almost 25.
Bordanek is a history teacher and athletic director at George Washington Carver High School. It's in an area that flooded. The classrooms are still all trailers. Today was supposed to be the first day of school, but a tropical storm warning canceled class. Which is okay, because Bordanek has plenty to do. He's in charge of a $2 million stadium that will replace the flooded school building.
Basically, so when this gets demolished, the field, the tip of the track will actually come right in front of this building right here.
Bordanek wrote the proposal, recruited the architects, and raised hundreds of thousands of dollars. In other places at his age, he'd only be interning on projects like this. Granted, he's not earning a high salary. Some of Bordanek's friends and family are not keen on him committing to the city.
A lot of people have a perception of New Orleans that it's a great place to visit, but not a great place to live. But once people were coming to visit, they turned doubters into believers really quick.
And he loves to plan elaborate weekends for guests.
Soul Rebels, live brass band, lunch at Domelisa's, a happy hour in the quarter, awesome dinner.
They tend to move in herds.
That's Leslie Jacobs, self-appointed muse of the YURPS, or Young Urban Rebuilding Professionals. Her group, 50 Forward, named for New Orleans area code, studies why thousands of 23 to 35-year-olds have flocked to New Orleans since Katrina hit.
Part of what our research showed is they want to be in cities where there's lots of them, and so it becomes almost a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Jacobs says they're drawn by a purpose to help rebuild a major American city. They're also needed. The storm drove out a generation of mid-career workers who would have been the next in line to run things.
A lot of people evacuated and didn't come back. It created opportunities for positions of leadership for younger people. When I was evacuated and watching the devastation on TV, I remember turning to my husband and saying, it's our kids' generation that's going to have to rebuild the city. You know, we're going to stabilize it, but we're going to be worn out from that.
But it's one thing to attract young people. It's another thing to get them to stay.
The young talent coming to New Orleans came here with the perception that they would work 2 to 3 years in a nonprofit, be part of rebuilding, and then go on and do something else. And our charge is that when they've reached that point, they still stay in New Orleans.
Some aren't sure they want to be part of New Orleans' future. 28-year-old John Moore grew up in New Orleans. As a teenager, he was eager to get out.
The entire time I was growing up here, I was one foot out the door sort of a thing.
Moore went to college in Atlanta and stayed to work in architecture. His mom and brother came to live with him after Hurricane Katrina. Flooding destroyed their house. Much to Moore's surprise, they went back to rebuild. He did not want to go with them until he attended a conference on green building.
The entire conference just seemed to have this New Orleans focus, and inevitably I would go to these meetings and I would be probably the only New Orleanian in the room. I was at the seat of power with a voice.
John Moore is now an environmental policy advisor for the city of New Orleans. He feels like he's shot forward decades in his career. And while he loves the occasional street parade or live concert,
I still sort of, even 4 years later, consider New Orleans a job. I think we're still dating. I can't see myself married to New Orleans just yet.
Moore wants to try life in New York, California, maybe Seattle. Leslie Jacobs at 50 Forward says she meets a lot of people with this city sampler life plan.
They're going to be restless and they're going to move on. But for a broad group of other people, New Orleans can be their home.
She says to get this group to call the Crescent City home, you have to change their mindset from short-term adventurers to long-term leaders. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace Money.
And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, more from New Orleans as we hear some financial lessons of Hurricane Katrina.
I always do try to put aside a little bit of cash to put away in savings in case, you know, I do have to pay for a hotel for a month.
Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman and Nancy Fargali. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Special thanks this week to Patty Hirsch. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, offering long-term investment strategies built on experience, discipline, and research. On the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. This is Putnam Today.
American Public Media.